Welcome to People of Color on Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Henry Banks. Thanks for joining us today. I'm here with Karen Brannon. Karen is a veteran journalist. She has written for numerous newspapers, magazines, stage, and television for nearly 50 years. Her work has appeared in Life, Mother Jones, Ms., Ladies Home Journal, Good Housekeeping, Today's Health, Learning, Parents, and the Star Tribune of Minneapolis, in addition to PBS, CBS, ABC, CBC, BBC, and CNN. I had the wonderful opportunity of meeting Karen in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, at the Dr. James Cameron Legacy Foundation annual Founders Day gathering and national conference. Karen, welcome to People of Color.
Thank you, Henry. It's wonderful to be here.
So when I met you in Milwaukee a couple of weeks ago, I was immediately struck by our brief conversation that we had there and learned that you had written a book called The Family Tree, A Lynching in Georgia, A Legacy of Secrets, and My Search for the Truth. And I was just simply intrigued and wanted to know more about your story. Would you take some time to tell our listeners a bit about your story?
Yes, Henry, I'll be happy to, though it's a hard story to talk about. I had heard little bits and pieces about this story when I was a child, growing up in Georgia and under Jim Crow in the 1940s and 50s, and I think I was about 11 years old when my father, who was a doctor but was also an alcoholic, told me that he had accidentally killed a young black woman when he was a young man, and this was one of the reasons that he drank so heavily and could not stop drinking, that he was punishing himself. He also told me that my grandfather, who was the sheriff, had from time to time been told to leave town, to get on the train, because some of the men wanted to take out a prisoner from the jail. That was all he told me, but I knew what he meant. I tucked those very frightening, troubling stories away somewhere in the recesses of my brain and really did not give them much of a second thought. They just became stories until I was middle-aged, in my 50s, actually, and they began to trouble me. And I was also very troubled by the fact that I was having a lot of nightmares around the fact that my son and his African-American girlfriend were about to have a baby. And I had considered myself fairly non-racist. Growing up in Georgia in the 40s and 50s, you couldn't help but be somewhat racist. But I worked very hard. I had been out of the South. I'd been involved in civil rights activities for 20, 30 years. And but I began to have some deep fears for this child, about this child. And I knew that I had to do something. And gradually, I explained in my book some of the very mysterious things that happened to me to pretty much point me back home and send me home to find out what had happened. And what I discovered in asking questions down there, it wasn't about my father and about this young black woman that he believed he had killed, for as it turned out, he really had killed no one. So that will forever remain a mystery to me as to what he was talking about and how he came to believe he had killed someone. But I discovered there had been a very horrible lynching under my great-grandfather's regime as sheriff of Harris County, Georgia. My grandfather at the time was deputy sheriff. He was 21 years old. He was the sheriff's son. And they had arrested four African Americans and had them, they actually had never been legally charged with anything. They were being held on suspicion of murdering the sheriff's nephew, Norman Hadley. My mother's family is named Hadley. There is a long line of sheriffs in that family. There is a long line of sheriffs all in the same county in my father's family as well. So a woman and three men were locked up in the Hamilton jail for a week under suspicion of the murder of Norman Hadley. There had been a lynching attempt on three of them as they were initially brought into the jail. My great-grandfather had talked the mob down and told them, justice will be done, but I want it to be done legally. And everybody in those days knew what that meant. We will, you know, these black folks will be hung, but we'll have a court thing to make that happen.
Let me ask you something. Harris County, Georgia, if you could share with our listeners where Harris County, Georgia is within proximity to Atlanta, Georgia. And what was the actual size of the town at the time?
Okay, good question. Harris County, Georgia is about 80 miles slightly southwest of Atlanta. It's on the Alabama line. The town, it was at the time about 900 people. I don't think it's even that large today.
Okay, so if you could continue with your story.
Yes, so they were being held in the jail, waiting for a trial. Several things happened in that week. Well, first I'd like to say I'll wait. There was no evidence against them. The only evidence that I was able to determine that my great-grandfather had was the woman, Dusky Crutchfield, who would become the first woman lynched in the state of Georgia, at least on record. She was to be the star witness. This murder of Norman Hadley had presumably happened on her front porch on a Saturday night. Something happened during that week, Henry, that screwed up my great-grandfather's plans. He lost his witness. Now, if you look back and you study a lot of court trials against African Americans in the South, which I did, I studied a lot of court trials, especially in Harris County, Georgia, you see that often the only witness, the only evidence would be an eyewitness. Mm-hmm. And often that eyewitness would be another black person. Subsequently, a lot of those convictions were thrown out because it was judged that the witness was coerced.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever coercion they may have brought to bear against Dusky Crutchfield, and I hate to think about what that might have been, it didn't work. The other three men in prison with her all had something in common that made them reasonable suspects. Because it turns out that Norman Hadley had been chasing a 14-year-old black girl by the name of Bertha Harrington. So one of the men in prison was Bertha Harrington's father, Gene Harrington, who was a farmer. One of the men was Bertha Harrington's preacher, Burl Hardaway, who was also a farmer but a part-time preacher in the AME church. The third person was Johnny Moore, and Johnny Moore was Bertha Harrington's 21-year-old fiancé. So, you know, there was a chance that even without a good witness, that circumstantial evidence might have condemned them in a court of law. But as the days went by and it began to come out exactly what was going on, and what this whole trial would have been about, which was interracial sex, there was no way that this was going to be a trial.
Mm-hmm.
So the lynch mob formed during those 7 days. And on the seventh day, which was the day that the sheriff legally had to let him go, you could only hold somebody under suspicion without evidence for 7 days. That was the day that the mob came to town, told the sheriff to get on the train, took the prisoners out at midnight, January 22nd, 1912. Death marched them to the Friendship Baptist Church, which was the Black Baptist Church in Hamilton. Hanged them and shot them 500 times.
500 times?
500 times.
Oh, my goodness.
Putting a bullet hole through Dusky Crutchfield's tongue.
Oh my word. And so I'm overwhelmed by the number of times they shot these individuals. And so do you believe then that was really the start of the Ku Klux Klan in that area?
Well, you know, the question of the Ku Klux Klan is an interesting one. I don't think, you know, the Ku Klux Klan was supposedly outlawed back in 1878 or something like that.
Right.
But there were always formations. There were always little local franchises of a non-existent Klan that would call themselves different things. This particular bunch of folks called themselves the Hamilton Avengers and claimed to be avenging the murder of Norman Hadley. Often they called themselves the Regulators. So if you study lynchings in the South during the so-called non-Klan period, you will come up with a lot of different names that they gave themselves. But there was always a Klan. You know, it just wasn't official.
So
the true Klan, though, started soon after. This was 1912. It started in 15. Yeah. And as I point out in my book, the founder of that Klan was an off-time visitor to Harris County because he was also a Methodist minister and he was also an insurance salesman. He sold Woodman of the World insurance. And Woodman of the World was actually a kind of a brotherhood. It was more than just an insurance company. So Norman Hadley's grave, to this very day, his tombstone is a Woodman of the World tombstone. So I was not able to find a direct connection, you know, between this guy and the Hamilton pre-Klan formation. But it wouldn't surprise me at all if it weren't there.
Mm-hmm. I am here with Karen Brannon. She is the Pulitzer Prize-nominated author of the book, The Family Tree, A Lynching in Georgia, A Legacy of Secrets, and My Search for the Truth. You know, 500 shots. I am just astounded by that number. But when you learned that your family members had an indirect part to do with some of the atrocious things that happened in Harris County, how did that make you feel?
Well, there are no words for how it made me feel. You know, how it still makes me feel, just sick. I shouldn't have been surprised, but I was. You know, I think we all, even though we may know a lot about this kind of stuff in other people's families or in general, we somehow wrap our own families in a protective gauze to protect us and them from those feelings. You know, I had no illusions that my family was non-racist. My family was racist. I never saw them as Klan-type racist. You know, I can't imagine my mother screaming at black children going to a, you know, previously white school. That just wasn't their style. But they were all deeply racist. You know, they all deeply supported and believed in segregation. And I was brought up to be a racist. At the same time, you know, my grandfather, who was the deputy sheriff at this lynching, at the time he was 21 years old. He was the sheriff of Harris County. When I was born, he became sheriff of Harris County in 1933. He maintained that office until he died in 1956. So for my entire experience with him, he was the sheriff. And to me, of course, to me, he was a kind. It's kind of like the mafia. You know, no mafia children think their parents are bad.
Right.
He was kind. He was gentle. he seemed to be liked and loved even by a number of the black folk in town. So I figured he had just somehow managed to overcome all the weaknesses and the cruelties of other small town, small county, southern sheriffs.
So, you know, when you started uncovering this, how did your family members approach you? Did they get upset, or had they all along wanted to tell this story? What was the result from your family once they learned you were uncovering the truth?
Well, you know, practically every possible reaction happened in different members of my family. So I got a little bit of each. My mother just lied, just out and out lied for most of the time. Later on, she gave me some very valuable information. One of her first cousins was the exact opposite. She wanted to know what happened. She had, as a two-year-old, she had actually seen the four people hanging. She had been taken down there and seen it, and she had never been able to forget about it, especially the hole in Dusky Crutchfield's tongue. And so she wanted to know what happened. So she actually helped me an enormous amount and went with me when I was down in Harris County. She had moved down to Columbus, but she always went, not always, but many times accompanied me, which was a great help because people were willing to talk to me more openly with Louise there because they had known her as children. So that was very helpful. Another one of my mother's sisters was pretty much like my mother. She zipped her lip. She did this gesture of zipping her lip and said that if that stuff got out, she would have to leave town. I think it was terrifying to them. They had carried this inside themselves for all these years in order to be acceptable, in order to be part of the better people, the better white people in Columbus, Georgia. And they felt that everything they had worked for and everything they had struggled for was at risk. But to their credit, none of them said, don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
None of them said, don't do it. And I think there was something in them that knew that in order for the family to heal, this had to come out.
And so for you, and again, uncovering this particular part of your family, I know when I talked to you in Milwaukee, you were saying that, you know, your son is in a relationship with an African-American woman.
Well, my son had a child with his high school girlfriend.
Okay.
And I have a granddaughter that is racially mixed. They did not. She went on to marry someone else. But my son has been very close to his daughter, and he has been very supportive of me in doing this all along the way. My sister has, I think it took her a while to kind of get used to the idea and to be able to trust what I was doing, how I was doing it. She has been my number one supporter ever since the book came out.
Wow, that is really great. So can you, Karen, talk about the racism and the power, the hatred, the bigotry, really, that permeated in such a small Georgia town, and how some of that has been symptomatic of what's going on in our country today?
I mean, I think there's a direct connection between then and now. You know, the thing is, what really surprised me, Henry, was what contradictions existed down there during those times. You know, they lived closely together. There was a whole network I discovered of what my mother, this was the important, valuable piece that my mother gave me. This system of two families where a white man would have a black family and a white family,
mm-hmm.
and everyone would know it. I mean, it was not, you know, equal at all, but they didn't run from it or hide from it. And this was part of what played into the lynching, this hypocrisy, this contradiction. And they were trying to stamp that out at the time, because this was 1912 and the North was coming into the, you know, had slowly, gradually been working its way back into the Union, getting white Northerners to be as racist as they were, but wanting to, you know, be a part of things and run things and not be looked down on. And there were a lot of Northern journalists that were writing about this hypocrisy of interracial sex and, you know, black children within white families. And so there was a whole movement to stamp this out. And there were, I discovered the youngest man who was lynched, John Moore, who was 21 years old, was a member of my family. And his family had actually, ever since slavery, been living right there, you know, on the farms, playing with my great-grandfather, being friends with. They were all in moonshine business together. So, you know, there was this kind of closeness. It's why slavery was called the peculiar institution, because of all this, you know, everybody being sharing DNA and yet not openly acknowledging it. So it wasn't like there was bitterness and hatred all over the place all the time. But it was the lie that everybody was being forced, that white people,
mm-hmm.
were being forced to live, that resulted in these violent eruptions. Like, okay, we've got to put an end to this.
Right.
Now, the other piece, though, is that, you know, number one, what's important is that both science and religion were teaching white people that black people were not their equal. You know,
mm-hmm.
physically, biologically, in any way. And most people really believed this, even leading theologians.
And they were saying also that Native Americans were not equal also.
Absolutely. That only white, that white people were superior.
Yes.
You know, white supremacy, white superiority. And often when they would talk about white people would talk about black people, it was in terms of their childishness. So we have to take care of them. We have to teach them. We know what's best. And that kind of paternalistic face was, you know, the face you saw most often in the South. But when everything is wrong, everything is based on a wrong, and so much sin has occurred, white against black, there's going to be violence.
Mm-hmm.
There's just going to be violence. The other thing that's important, the white folks were constantly, I mean, the papers were filled with predictions of black violence, black riots, black conspiracies. I was just amazed to see this. In Harris County, Georgia, often there would be, we understand that the darkies are organizing, guns have been stolen from the militia, et cetera, et cetera. 2 or 3 days later, there would be a retraction of that. I never was able to find anything happening, actually happening.
So was that done, though, in your opinion? Do you believe that was done just simply to incite the populace?
It's hard to know. You know, it's hard to get in people's heads back then. But I think because they lived with this fear, it was often easy to see something that way, even if it wasn't. You know, if guns had disappeared from the militia shack or whatever, your first thought is it's those black guy, people that are finally, you know, organizing to rise up and, you know, claim what's theirs, that kind of thing. And I think we're still, you know, we've still got that. I think white people are scared to death of black people for no, you know, not for any real reason,
mm-hmm.
but for, you know, knowing that it just carried, that's just been passed down generation to generation.
I'm going to ask you if you can expand on that and help us really understand why there is such fear of people of color, but more specifically, why are white folks so fearful of African American people?
Because of all the wrongs that we have done to you.
Mm-hmm.
There's a, I can't remember which Native American group, there was a Native American chief who once said, people never forgive their victims. People never forgive their victims. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's sort of his way of saying what I'm trying to say, which is we will never, we will, you know, and until white people confront their crimes against black people, apologize and make reparations of some sort, there will be this fear. Mm-hmm. There will be this distance. And, you know, I have to be careful not to equate my own experience too closely with a larger situation. But in my, I never knew. And, you know, most white people don't really experience on a day-to-day basis the distance between themselves and black people.
Right.
Or any kind of real obvious fear. And I certainly didn't, because I had been involved in all kinds of interracial activities for most of, you know, ever since I left Georgia when I was 20 years old.
And you're in Washington, D.C. now.
Yeah, I live in D.C. now, but I've lived all over the country.
Sure.
And I've been involved with all kinds of different civil rights activities. And yet when I went on this journey and when I confronted not just this lynching, this is just, you know, that's just the tip of the iceberg, but all the ways that my ancestors contributed to an unjust society in some rather major ways, I felt this falling away of a barrier between me and African Americans that I did not know was even there.
Hmm.
You know, I found that I could sit in a room and look people in the eye and tell the truth.
Well, you know, when I met you, though, in Milwaukee,
uh-huh,
I was immediately connected to you.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, that's how it's been.
Yeah, I felt an immediate connection. I was overwhelmed by that, actually. I never told you that, but I immediately connected with you and said I needed to know more about you as a person because I knew and felt that your heart was genuine.
Well, you know, I really appreciate that, Henry. I sense that that's the case with a lot of other African Americans. You know, very few are as open and honest about it as you've just been. But it certainly has been the case for me, you know. And I began to remember times years ago. You know, I remember once I was in some kind of a race workshop at Unitarian Church right down the street from where I'm sitting right now. And it was about half black, half white. And for no reason that I could put my fingers on, my face turned red. I just found my face was on fire. I felt so much shame. And I did not know what that shame was all about.
Mm-hmm.
Now I can think of thousands of reasons, you know. But I was so blocked, and I told myself, you know, it had been so important for me to think of myself as not racist. And so, you know, when I go out and talk to white people, I say, you know, if you think you're not racist, you probably are, you know. I mean, and I'm not saying I'm not anymore. You know, it's hard to live in this country and be white and not be.
Mm-hmm.
But it is something that we can, there are ways we can deal with it. And everybody won't, you know, have my background. But millions of people do. If 5,000 people were lynched, you know, that makes for a lot of white folks whose ancestors did it.
And those were reported lynchings.
Absolutely. Yeah, they're probably 15 or 20.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm here with Karen Brannon. She is the author of The Family Tree and Lynching in Georgia, A Legacy of Secrets and My Search for the Truth. We're on People of Color on Wisconsin Public Radio. I want to ask you, Karen, if you could take just a moment to speak to our young listeners and our young leaders in the area.
Uh-huh.
That if they're just learning about lynchings, for example, for the first time, and how lynchings impacted America, what would you say to them as they start to understand this part of American history?
Oh, my. Well, you know, lynchings, number one, this whole history of lynchings, while right now it's very much in the news and people are connecting it to current murders by policemen, and there's a very direct connection between those lynchings going back to slavery days, going back to the beginning of this country up until, you know, even I think the last lynching that is called a lynching was in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. But now people are beginning to call the police murders lynchings as well. You know, they haven't ended. They haven't ended. The bottom line for me on this, Henry, is that white people have always needed a scapegoat. We cut ourselves so much slack. In Harris County, Georgia, it was hard to find a case where a white man was even punished, much less put to death, for a murder, even of another white man. There were many, many, many white-on-white murders in Harris County, Georgia. There was no white man ever executed for one of those murders. Now, this goes on to this very day. There are far fewer whites punished for murders per capita than blacks. Somebody has to be a scapegoat when that is happening. When white people are so privileged and getting away with so much, somebody has to pay. And who pays in our society is the African-American, usually male, but not always. So, you know, I think that the other thing I'm discovering when I go out and talk, young and old African-Americans tell me, I have never been able to get my parents to talk about these things. I went out thinking that African-Americans knew about these things, and it was the white perpetrators who covered up their crimes. But there's a sense of shame about having been lynched or being in a family where there was a lynching. And that's got to change. Somebody's got to, you know, put a halt to that. It was a traumatizing experience. And lynchings and now these police killings are used to keep people scared. And, you know, we cannot live with one another, and we cannot live in a democracy. We cannot even begin to think about having a democracy, which we don't have yet.
Right.
Until we stop being afraid.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I am going out and I am saying to young African Americans, ask the questions, you know, be gentle, be kind, but within your family, ask the questions. Say, if you live in the North and you know your grandparents lived in the South, and somewhere along the lines they got out of the South, ask why. If you've got a mother who grew up in the South but refuses to go back, ask why. You know, try to get to the roots of some of that family pathology that was created back there in those days. And I say this to black and white because it's not the same, and I don't try to make it an equal thing, but we are all traumatized by these things.
I agree. I agree with that 100%.
It's been passed down from generation to generation, and I made the decision that I was not going to do that to one more generation, which I was close to doing because I was close to keeping my beautiful granddaughter from her white relatives, hiding her. And I did not have to do that because of this journey that went on and what I discovered. And what I discovered, the message in all of this was, we are all family. And I have discovered dozens and dozens of African Americans that I am related to now through DNA tests. I have found Johnny Moore, the youngest man lynched in 1912. I have found a direct descendant of his who lives very close to me now in Maryland, and she and I have become very good friends. And there have been many such situations like that that I never would have been privy to. these beautiful friendships and relationships and kinships that I've discovered as a result of discovering this horrible, horrible lynching.
Let me ask you this, if you would talk a bit about if we're truly going to heal as a country, do you believe it to be of the utmost importance that communities, small or large, come to terms with lynchings, to own these tragedies, and then help each other to build a beloved community in spite of this American phenomenon?
Yes. You know, one of the things that March 18th, I'm going down to LaGrange, Georgia, and this will be my fourth visit to LaGrange, Georgia in about 6 months, which is a wonderful model for this to have. What is happening there is a wonderful role model for a lot of, you know, every community doesn't have lynchings. Most communities do have incidents of racial violence, mm-hmm. and just systemic racism, you know, exists everywhere. But in LaGrange, a 16-year-old African-American boy was lynched in 1940. He was dragged out of the police station. I went down last summer to speak at LaGrange College. They had formed a racial reconciliation and trust building group made up of 150 very solid members of the community, the mayor, head of city council, state legislator, judge, the police chief, and then all kinds of other people, just regular people. And I spoke about this lynching. They had been meeting for a year, doing exercises, just learning to trust each other. LaGrange, Georgia is like every other city in Georgia, deeply divided along the color line. Mm-hmm. At the end of my talk, the police chief came over to me and said, and asked me if I knew about the lynching of Austin Calloway, this 16-year-old. I said, yes, I had heard of it. And he said, I am thinking about making an apology because it happened because he was not properly protected by the police. I said, I think that's wonderful.
Yes.
So on January 26th, just this past January, I went down and an AME church held the service, and it was packed with black and white people. And the apology came from the police chief, from the mayor, from a judge, from the university president, from a city councilman. This was the first time that a police chief had apologized in this country for a lynching.
Wow.
It was only the second time that any public official has apologized, and that was in Waco. I have been trying to get the mayor of Columbus, Georgia, which is my hometown, to make an apology for an 1897 lynching that took place there. That's not happening.
Let me stop you for just a moment, if you don't mind. So
sure.
The 1920 lynching in Duluth, Minnesota,
yes.
Where the three men, Elias Clayton, Elmer Jackson, and Isaac McGee, were lynched. The current police chief in Duluth, Minnesota, is the great-nephew of the woman who accused the three men of raping her. I don't believe a public apology has been given by the police chief here. And so that might be something that people listening may want to inquire about.
Uh-huh. Yeah. That would be a wonderful thing to have happen.
That's right. And so I'm hoping that my listeners will take advantage of that and just give a call and find out when and if that is going to happen.
Absolutely. I believe this thing in LaGrange, which was very widely publicized, is going to, you know, they're starting to get calls from other public officials asking about, you know, how is this working out for you? You know, is it, you know, are you glad you did it? How did you come about to do it? And all that. So I'm expecting more and more of this will happen. What was so encouraging to me about the LaGrange apology is that it was so clear that it was not a pro forma apology. It mm-hmm. wasn't just to, you know, sort of say I'm sorry and move on. There was a deep commitment coming out of that day to changing policy, to changing practices. I know the police chief has been working with his force to improve their arrest practices, to do a lot of things better than they have been doing. So he was very clear. He said to me, whatever comes of this, I don't want it to be seen as showboating. It's got to be something with deep roots that makes a difference in the community for years to come.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes from the heart, it really has a great impact.
Yes, it does. And that's where it has to come from.
Absolutely. I'm here with Karen Brannon. I do thank you for taking the time to be with us today on People of Color, the author of the book, The Family Tree. I want to ask a few additional questions related to what's going on in the country right now with regard to African-American people. The mass incarceration of blacks in this country is atrocious.
Yeah.
And in my opinion, has a great deal to do with our past as a country that has always disrespected black men to the point of intentional obliteration. Why, in your opinion, do you believe we have not truly addressed this mass incarceration rate in our country?
Oh, Henry, you ask hard questions.
I'm sorry.
Well, you know, how do I say it? You know, there's a movie out called I Am Not Your Negro with James Baldwin.
Yes.
Which I actually am going to see tomorrow. But I've read a quote from him in that movie in which he says that there is something in white people that needs a nigger.
Wow.
And until white people figure out what that is and do something about it, this nation will not move forward. And I think this is the ultimate question. This is the answer to that question is the answer to it's a question you gave to me. And I think there are a lot of answers to that question. But I think that is the important. I know it's not a nice, satisfying answer for me to give. But we are locking up real, real men, women, and children of color as a substitute for not dealing with things within ourselves that are criminal, that are violent, that are stealing. Does this make sense to you?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
You know, all the things that white people do to other people is about that, because so long as we believe that we are the norm, that we are the standard, that we are the white hats, you know, we do not. And I hate using we because this does not include everybody.
Right.
But, you know, that self-inventory, that deep inner work, that purging of you know, not just purging, but accepting of what is dark within us. And what we do is we project that. And I talk about this a little bit in my book. I'm actually writing another book that deals with this more deeply. Projecting what we reject in ourselves onto other people. And, you know, unfortunately and sadly and tragically, most of that projection is aimed at black males. You know, to try and do something about that, I mean, a lot of this is about, you know, there was a kind of mass incarceration, a level of mass incarceration that took place at the end of slavery, and it became known as convict labor. blacks began to be arrested. Laws were passed making things illegal that, you know, only applied to black people, the black codes, they were called. It was very easy to get thrown in jail if you were a freed black slave, a former black slave, in the South. People were rounded up. They were charged money they didn't have, to pay for minor fines for, disturbing the peace. They went to jail for years. And this became the new slavery because individual plantation owners and businesses and railroads and major corporations could hire convicts. Now, the state became the plantation manager. The state got the money. So, once again, you had white people benefiting from enslaved labor. It's in the DNA. So white, the people that run the economy, corporate heads and, white power brokers, look at a black body and they see a way to make money.
Wow.
Now, what's going on now, I mean, even prisons are making money. Private prisons are making money.
That's right.
From these black bodies that are locked up. So, a certain sect of the society is making money, once again, from slave labor.
Mm-hmm. Privatized.
Yes.
So
yes, privatization.
It absolutely is. I always ask my guest also to talk a bit about the miseducation of children of all colors in this country. And I want to get your perspective on that. I know that children of color in a lot of school districts across the country are not graduating on time. And when they actually graduate, they're not necessarily prepared for the next level of their lives. Could you comment on that?
Oh, Henry, apart from the saddest place in America are the prisons. The second saddest places in America are the schools.
Mm-hmm.
Especially predominantly African-American schools. I don't even really know where to start to tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm.
The money's not there. The teaching expertise is not there. There are some places that are doing an excellent job. When you see the excellent schools, you see the excellence that black students can attain. I think that, right now, over the schools have been resegregated. I don't know, this is a controversial idea, but it studies show, and I always hesitate to say that because there are always exceptions, but studies show that students, black and white, do better in integrated schools than they do in segregated schools. Black and white students do.
Yeah.
We benefit from being with one another.
It's a wonderful thing.
Yes,
it's a wonderful thing.
And the saddest thing that goes on in this country, if you take children, I have spent a lot of my life as a teacher. I ran a school for a while. I wrote about education and child rearing for about 20 years. You put black and white and red and yellow and every kind of kid in a room together, and you do not see discrimination. It's not a natural thing.
Mm-hmm.
The older they get, the more it happens because they absorb it from the culture. But naturally, children, and I believe people really of all ages, if you take away all the bad influences, there is no innate racism.
Right.
It's taught. It's
right.
taught. It's taught. And it's taught overtly and it's taught subtly as well.
Absolutely.
I live in a city that is probably the best city I've ever lived in terms of the races getting along and being open with one another. We've still got major problems in Washington, D.C., But, you know, I have seen things work in a way that I never was able to see things work in Georgia. Mm-hmm. And I'm really grateful for that. But I want it for the whole country. I want people to wake up and see how we are all depriving ourselves. And, you know, this is what I say to white people who feel like they are going to lose something, who feel like they have to give up something. I say, no. I mean, actually, you are depriving yourself now by staying rooted in your white racism. You have no idea what's on the other side of that. None of us can even imagine what a grand and glorious democracy we could have if we would stop being so fearful of one another, if we would really question our attitudes and assumptions and all those old things that we have been taught. And if you open your heart, go out and find your African-American kinfolks. That's what I've done. I've desegregated my life almost entirely, and I'm a much happier and freer person as a result.
Wow, this has been a great conversation. Karen Brannon is the author of The Family Tree, A Lynching in Georgia, A Legacy of Secrets, and My Search for the Truth. The book is published by Atria Books, and that's a subsidiary, I believe, of Simon & Schuster. Karen, how might our listeners get a copy of your book?
Run, don't walk to your nearest bookstore or library. I think you told me it's in your local library.
Yes, it is.
They can also go on my website, which is KarenBrannon.com, and order one there. They can order it from Amazon or any number of online bookstores. It's pretty much everywhere, and the paperback just came out, so they can get it for a little bit less money.
All right. Thank you again for your time. I know you're very busy in Washington, D.C., and all over the country, and an honor to meet you, and a pleasure to talk to you. I hope to see you very soon.
Oh, thank you, Henry. I've enjoyed this very much. Thank you.
Take care.